from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey everyone, it is 4 o'clock in New York. I'm Alicia Menendez, in for Nicole Wallace. We are following the breaking new developments in the House investigation into the January 6th insurrection. Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, now cooperating with the House Select Committee. Committee Chairman Benny Thompson revealing in a statement today that, quote, Mr. Meadows has been engaging with the Select Committee through his attorney. He has produced records to the committee and will soon appear for an initial deposition. Thompson adding, the Select Committee expects all witnesses, including Mr. Meadows, to provide all information requested and that the Select Committee is lawfully entitled to receive. The committee will continue to assess his degree of compliance with our subpoena after the deposition. It follows news reported this morning by The Washington Post that the committee had been poised to vote to hold Meadows in contempt, quote, before the week is over. And news that the committee is planning to hold a vote tomorrow to advance contempt proceedings for another former Trump official, Jeffrey Clark, who served as acting head of the DOJ Civil Division toward the end of Trump's presidency and plotted with Trump to oust acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen as part of an attempt to overturn the results of Georgia's elections. The developments in the House investigation come as a legal case critical to that probe sits before a D.C. Court of Appeals. This morning, arguments by Donald Trump's lawyers to keep secret a broad swath of records that could provide insight into his actions on the day of the insurrection in the days and weeks before their case met with apparent skepticism by the three presiding judges. From Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, quote, this all boils down to who decides. Who decides when it is the best interest of the United States to disclose presidential records? Is it the current occupant of the White House or the former? Later interjecting that, according to legal precedent, quote, when you have a conflict of incumbent and former, the incumbent gets to decide. Judge Patricia Mallet, another member of the panel, adding, quote, we have one president at a time under our Constitution. The mounting setbacks for Donald Trump's attempts to obstruct the January 6th committee investigation is where we begin today. Jackie Alemani is here, Washington Post congressional correspondent and author of the Early 202 newsletter. Basil Smichel, Democratic strategist and director of the public policy program at Hunter College. And Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour, moderator of Washington Week, as well as an MSNBC contributor. It is good to see you all, Jackie. I'm going to start with you. Meadows has been engaged with investigators in negotiating the terms of his deposition, turning over documents. But the pace of these negotiations had the committee weighing more aggressive measures against him. Is his cooperation a sign that enforcing these subpoenas with threats of contempt is actually working?
I think it does, Alicia. And that's what we've heard from this committee all along. They've said in the wake of Steve Bannon's indictment, the DOJ decided to prosecute the criminal contempt case against him earlier this month, that they thought it had achieved its goal of essentially scaring some of these witnesses into cooperating. But Meadows has been more, I would say, dignified about the process since the commencement of the investigation. He hired a very reputable lawyer, George Terwilliger, who has been in constant touch with the committee in order to sort of document the steps that they've been willing to take in order to show that they are different from Steve Bannon and Jeffrey Clark, even Trump's former DOJ official who seemed willing to help the former president in terms of overturning the results of the election. There is a contrast between people like Clark and Mark Meadows. That's why we're going to see Clark be most likely voted to be held in contempt by the committee that will then get referred to the House on Wednesday night. We'll see if it makes it out of the House eventually to the DOJ, where they'll then decide whether or not they're going to prosecute that. But this is a good start for the committee when it comes to Mark Meadows. He is considered very key to the investigation. He was with President Trump on January 6th. The committee has said in previous records, requests and releases that they believe Meadows does have some documents that could be insightful and provide new information on the president's decision making and mindset on the day of the insurrection. So we'll see how much they're actually able to ultimately obtain from Trump's former chief of staff.
Yeah, Yamiche, let's talk about those documents, what we do and what we don't know. We know from previous reporting by the New York Times that in Mr. Trump's final weeks in office, he repeatedly pushed the Justice Department to investigate unfounded conspiracy theories about the 2020 presidential election. That's according to emails provided to Congress, portions of which were reviewed by the New York Times. Mr. Meadows was also in communication with the organizers of the rally on January 6th that preceded the violence. How significant is Meadows' testimony likely to be if he's turning over records relevant to those interactions and will be forced to testify under oath?
I think the significance will be in the details. Yes, he is engaging in the committee, and yes, it sounds like he is providing documents, but what are those documents? What do they say? What do they do? How revealing are they about the president's state of the former president's state of mind and the state of mind of Mark Meadows himself? He was a chief of staff to the president. He was in the room all the time. He was there on January 6th by the president's side. And as you said, he was in touch with these rally goers. So I think we really need to figure out sort of what is the level of communication and engagement. We know that he is engaging. I've talked to some sources, Democrats and Republicans, and they really make this point very clear. Steve Bannon, a charge for him, a criminal charge for him. He wants to be a martyr. He wants to be able to go on his podcast and rallies and talk about sort of how he's had to face legal consequences for being loyal to president, to former President Trump. Mark Meadows is a different person. Mark Meadows, he wants to have a political future. He wants to possibly be in a different sort of crowds. He does not want, based on the sources I'm talking to, he is not someone who might be embracing the idea of criminal charges and being criminally convicted of contempt. So that to me is also, I think, telling here the level of people that are being subpoenaed and sort of what are their personal wishes and personal sort of calculations for how far they'll go in their loyalty to the former president.
Right. And Basil, all of this foot dragging sort of has served two purposes. It both is one, to evade responsibility, to never have to answer for what happened. And two, to just slow things down, plain and simple. As Congressman Raskin told Greg Sargent at The Washington Post, their goal is obviously to run out the clock before the American people get the truth. We're in a race against the clock here. That clock, Basil, it is ticking. Are Democrats moving fast enough?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, because there was a point in time where I wasn't sure that they were. I didn't know that we would actually get this kind of cooperation, albeit through subpoena. I didn't think that we would ever really get to this point, and I'm actually glad that we are. It does seem to be that there is movement. And to Yamiche's point earlier, which I think is an important one, you know, you have someone like Steve Bannon that's willing to don a sword and be the martyr. But we're dealing mostly with people who want careers in politics still, people that you and I probably don't want to see in government unless they actually, you know, come before this committee and testify to what exactly happened. Their credibility is on the line. The American democracy, as has been talked about exorbitantly, is certainly at question here, and our institutions are in question here. And I am glad to see that there is movement. Now, I don't know that this happens in a way that will affect the midterms. But I can say that it would be an important talking point for the president, for members of Congress going out there to say that we were the ones that were standing up for our democracy, for our institutions. The hope is that it does translate and have traction. Not sure that it will, but it's important that we have the ability to say that.
Well, Jackie, talking about the midterms, talking about that messaging, there is the action. That's what we've all been talking about. But there also then is the messaging around this political reporting that outside of the White House, Democrats are arguing that Biden's willingness to make more aggressive attacks against Republicans will be key to their success in 2022. Quote, they want him to go after Republicans for pushing voter restriction laws and embracing former President Donald Trump's lies of election fraud and revisionist January 6th history. Jackie, one, does that square with your own reporting, the sort of sense from Democrats that this is what needs to happen? And given that this case needs to be fought in the court of public opinion at the ballot box and in the courtroom, understanding it's all of the above. Where do Democrats believe that the messaging on this comes into play?
It's a really interesting game that we're watching Democrats, specifically vulnerable Democratic candidates or Democrats running in red swingy areas, are playing at the moment. We're already seeing in real time an attempt to distance themselves from President Biden. You saw Beto O'Rourke tell CNN over the weekend, I believe it was, that he wasn't sure that he wanted Joe Biden to come to Texas to campaign with him. But you also see some suggestions on the messaging that they want to see from the president, how he actually can be helpful. And that is by playing bad cop, attacking Republicans, and calling out a lot of policies that they've been able to implement at a state level that Biden hasn't been successful in actually implementing from a federal level. He has not, and the Democratic Congress has not been able to get a lot of the priorities that he campaigned on done, from voting rights to police reform to gun control. So instead, they would like to see, and what I'm hearing from members and Democratic lawmakers on the Hill, him sort of ramp up that rhetoric, which really is anathema to the Joe Biden that we saw run on the campaign trail in 2020. This is someone who has prided himself on, you know, being able to work with Republicans. But we are seeing in real time the limits of that strategy, especially as we're coming up against the new year. And again, you know, there are some of Biden's key economic agendas and other, again, campaign promises have yet to be fulfilled.
You know, Basil, it strikes me that you make this compelling argument for this needing to be a part of the message, and then you end your answer with, but I'm not sure it will. What would it take to get Democrats to unify behind this idea that they need to make it clear that the existential threat to our democracy and the project of Democrats winning in 2022 is one and the same?
You know, I talk about this a lot. It's new visions and new voices and new arenas. And I say that because I do understand the concern about bringing Joe Biden into a state like Texas, for example, and perhaps he's not the best messenger. Our work is the best message that we can project and promote, because the work that mayors across the country, that governors across the country are doing to get people back to work, to get our economy up and running so that we are staying safe. The fact that you have so many amazing young new mayors across the country that the Democrats can say, we did this, we put them there. Those are people that we should be elevating. You let Joe Biden come in at the end, if you will, but then elevate all of these other folks, because they're people that we would love to see as new standard bearers of the party. We have a new mayor in the city of New York who desperately wants to be the new face of the Democratic Party. Give him a shot at that. So I do think that the messaging can be unifying. Joe Biden doesn't have to lead it, but he certainly has to be there at the end to say, this is the party that this is our party. This is my party. But there are tons of other voices that could be elevated in the meantime.
Right. I mean, because Jackie, there is both 2022 and then there's just the future of democracy writ large and making sure that there is accountability for what happened so that it never happens again. And all of this is playing out as a D.C. appeals court hears arguments over the former president's efforts to block records. Comments, as you heard at the top of the show from the three judges in today's case, seem to suggest they're going to side against Donald Trump when it comes to hundreds of White House records that are now housed at the National Archives that he is seeking to block. What could this mean for the committee?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Alicia. A three-judge panel expressed skepticism about the role of the courts in deciding which side of this dispute, whether or not a former president or a sitting president ultimately gets to make the call on the release of White House records. But they seem to be leaning towards the idea that a sitting president makes that ultimate decision, which Joe Biden has already said he's in favor of doing. But at the end of the day, regardless of how these judges decide, it's likely to get intervened by the Supreme Court. This was a 3.5-hour hearing that we watched today that really explored the limits of the separations of powers, but the judges didn't exactly say when they were going to be making that decision. They did seem to indicate, though, that they understand the urgency of the task at hand for the panel, that they are trying to collect a ton of information as expeditiously as possible. And these documents from the National Archives are going to be really important, and the panel has expressed as much so far, for their ultimate findings to create a comprehensive record of what exactly happened on January 6th.
Yeah, I mean, Yumish, the Biden administration has, of course, come out against Biden's, against the former president's executive privilege claims. There are critics who still feel Biden's DOJ not doing enough fast enough to ensure justice is done in the January 6th case. Your sense from behind the scenes inside the administration of whether they believe there is appropriate urgency or if there needs to be more?
Well, I think when you talk to White House officials, especially President Biden, he has been very clear that he wants to be sort of really separated from the DOJ. He wants to really go back to the DOJ as an independent entity, something that was, as we all can, I think, agree, lost in the last 4 years when the former president was doing all sorts of things, including demanding that the DOJ go after people who are his enemies. So I think President Biden, in some ways, is really trying to do that and really trying not to sort of not be seen as pressuring the DOJ. That being said, White House officials have been very clear. The president's been very clear. They see January 6th as a monumental moment in history. They see it as a stain on American democracy. They see it as as the threat to democracy, as an existential threat. The president's been pretty clear about that. So I think there is this feeling that, at least among the administration, while they don't want to pressure the DOJ, that they feel like the DOJ is being urgent enough. That, of course, is different from a base. You have the Democratic base, much like others have said, that are looking at sort of policing reform, looking at voting reform, looking at all these things that President Biden wanted to get done and not seeing it get done. And they're also seeing all of these voting rights bills, these restrictive voting rights bills, go up in different states, and looking at the DOJ saying, what more can you do, as we're seeing bills and GOP lawmakers sort of I think really chip away at democracy in a lot of people's minds, critics' minds especially. So I think there is that sort of that wanting to see more from the DOJ. But my sense talking to administration officials is that they think the DOJ is doing what the DOJ needs to do.
Yeah, Basil, I wonder how you square those two things, the administration, you know, wanting to reestablish DOJ as an independent entity, and then the political reality of having a base that wants more done and wants that more done faster.
Clearly, we've been talking about criminal justice reform, and certainly what's happening across the country with voter suppression is something squarely in line with what DOJ should be working on. And that's the one area where I do believe Joe Biden really needs to come a lot stronger, because you cannot be aggressive, you can't be strong by playing within somebody else's rules. And it sometimes feels as though the Republicans have set up these rules, these guidelines that Democrats are playing within. And that's not a winning strategy. You need to reassert the rules of engagement and restate them. And I think that's where Joe Biden can draw that kind of strength. But if we don't do that, and if we don't do that with the institutions that are sort of that he's in charge of in the bureaucracy, then what other playing field do we have left? That's really the problem here. So, yeah, you got to get more aggressive. DOJ can lead this charge. But if they don't have the weapons, the tools, or don't have the sort of call from on high to do so, then we're going to be having this conversation for years to come, and then wondering or perhaps not questioning why Democrats have been losing, because we had power and we didn't use it.
Right. We may be asking the question about why Democrats lose. We may be asking a question about what happened to our democracy. Jackie Alemani, thank you for starting us off this hour. Basil Yumish, you are sticking with me. More on where the congressional investigation into January 6th goes next. We're going to be joined by committee member Pete Aguilar on what his initial deal with Mark Meadows looks like. That is coming up. But when we come back, the new COVID variant, the White House task force today echoing the president's message not to panic. How should Americans prepare for a potential new stage of this pandemic? We're going to discuss that. And later in the program, reproductive rights under siege. Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case that takes direct aim at the nearly 50-year-old decision of Roe v. Wade. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues. After this, do not go anywhere.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
the curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
It is very difficult to know whether or not this particular variant is going to result in severe disease. We've said it over and over again, and it deserves repeating. If you're not vaccinated, get vaccinated. Get boosted if you are vaccinated. Continue to use the mitigation methods, namely masks, avoiding crowds and poorly ventilated spaces.
Dr. Fauci this afternoon on the big unknowns of the potential new Omicron COVID variant, but stressing the immediate tools we do have. While it hasn't been detected here in the U.S., the Biden administration's top doctors are backing the president's message that the variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. The CDC has stepped up its advice on booster shots, now saying all U.S. adults should get one. It also comes amid new Wall Street fears about the economic impact of another variant. A new Washington Post reporting today that in the last few days, senior White House officials have been working to determine whether more congressional approved funding will be needed to respond to new problems that arise from the variant. Let's bring in MSNBC medical contributor Dr. Uche Blackstock, founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity. Basil Smichel and Yamiche Alcindor are back with us. Dr. Blackstock, what do you make of the continued messaging today by the Biden administration that we don't know the impact on transmission, vaccine efficacy, and disease severity? Speak to the importance of keeping up mitigation measures that Dr. Fauci mentioned.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Alicia. Yeah, I think, you know, even if we do not know the properties of this new variant, we still have the tools in the toolbox to protect ourselves. So as Dr. Fauci mentioned, absolutely, people should get vaccinated if they haven't been vaccinated, get boosted if you haven't been boosted. But there are other strategies that we have to really encourage people and states and localities to use. So masking, we know, is incredibly important to reducing the spread. We need rapid tests available to all U.S. households. It should be free, available, and accessible. We also need for there to be a supportive household that people need to be quarantined. There should be groceries or resources delivered in isolation facilities. So again, in order to protect ourselves from this new variant, even though we don't know all the properties, we do have the tools. It's a matter of actually using them and implementing them on an individual and policy basis.
Yeah, I mean, Yamiche, there's a lot unknown right now for the variant, for the Biden administration. Jonathan Lemire reports the sudden emergence of the Omicron variant has sparked fears of another devastating wave of the virus, one that could endanger the White House's plans to focus on Biden's legislative agenda and efforts to battle inflation and a bottlenecked supply chain. Within the walls of the West Wing, there was recognition of the political peril that looms, along with an implicit recognition that the public may not be willing to stomach the more dramatic measures to combat the new variant, even if Biden asks them to. What are you hearing from Biden administration officials about how they plan to balance all of these realities, a new variant, COVID fatigue, economic fears?
What I'm hearing is that they are in some ways going to follow the science. It's the thing that the president, President Biden, has said from day one. And that means in some ways evolving different regulations and rules and telling people what sort of the CDC is saying. I mean, I think the president's been very clear in that he doesn't want more lockdowns, more shutdowns. And I think it's pretty clear from the American people that there's a sense of fatigue with the pandemic. But also we have to deal with the fact that we want to try to keep people safe. And we, meaning really the country, everyone wants to stay safe and not die of this virus. So really the president in some ways is having to juggle the sort of real fear that this Omicron variant, without knowing whether or not it's going to cause more severe, whether it's going to end up in the United States sooner than later, and whether or not it could at least maybe be less effective when it comes to the vaccines. All of those things are sort of leading sort of what they're going to be doing against this virus. I will say that when I talk to officials, there is this sense, and they repeat this to me. This is why the president really sort of doubled down on the idea that he had a lot of experience, because he had experience juggling a lot of chaos when he was vice president and when he was in office for 3 decades. And now, of course, as president of the United States, he's having to deal with a pandemic and inflation and, of course, his legislative agenda. So in some ways, this is a sort of world that he, in some ways, they would say he envisioned for himself and for the job. That being said, of course, this is a heavy load for anyone watching. And I think it, in some ways, it really does strike me that Democrats are really sort of understanding that this is going to be a very long December with a lot of challenges and a lot of complications.
Right. And I want to loop back to the politics of that, Basil. But before I do, Dr. Blackstock, the reason I wanted to talk to you very specifically today is because since the early days of the pandemic, you have been consistent on the point that a winning strategy required centering equity, that until the vaccine was truly available to everyone, home testing available to everyone, effective, well-fitting masks available to everyone, we would not be able to truly deal with this virus. That is true both in a domestic context and it is true in a global context. From that vantage point, what do you want to see? What more from the Biden administration and other leaders next?
Thank you for asking that, Alicia. You know, we're still not there yet. And I think we almost need a reset in how we're managing this pandemic. The fact is that more people have died this year from COVID-19 than last year. And vaccines were rolled out in December. So that tells us that we're not doing this right. And so what I would like to see is for the Biden administration to continue to work with states, continue to work with governors, you know, on their weekly calls, encourage as much as they can mask mandates. We know that works. I think that we need to also work, obviously, on the vaccine mandates that are hung up in court. But whatever legal maneuvers can be done to push those through, that needs to happen. And then obviously from an equity standpoint, at the very least, you know, every household should have free, well-fitting masks, rapid tests available to them, because we know at this time, especially we're in the middle of a Delta surge, we have a new variant here, will be detected soon. We know that all of those layers are incredibly important. And so I feel like we're not even doing the bare minimum for the American people. We are not even just following basic public health measures. And a lot of it's because I think there's obviously concern about COVID fatigue. There's concern about the economy. But the fact is that we will not round the bend in this pandemic if we don't get cases down and deaths down. We still have 1,000 people dying a day. So we can't talk about off-ramp until we address those public health measures. And that's through policies. It's not just through individuals knowing to do the right thing, but what happens on a local state level as well.
Well, Basil, I want to add one piece to Dr. Blackstock's incredible analysis, which is in addition to COVID fatigue, in addition to the economic realities, you also have a political party that is actively trying to stop this down. A federal judge yesterday blocked the Biden administration in 10 states from enforcing a federal vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. The ruling was in response to lawsuits in those states, all of them with a Republican AG or governor. Axios reports on how Republicans are working to rally their base by aligning the party with the unvaccinated, quote, Florida, Iowa, Kansas, and Tennessee have changed their unemployment insurance rules to allow workers who were fired or quit over vaccine mandates to receive benefits. 9 GOP-controlled states have passed laws requiring exemptions for the Biden administration's vaccine mandate or banning private companies from requiring vaccination altogether. That's according to the National Academy for State Health Policy. At least 20 bills have been introduced to chip away at Biden's mandate. So, Basil, 60 million eligible adults still unvaccinated as a new variant spreads. A Republican Party that is aligning itself with the unvaccinated. It's not just COVID fatigue. It's not just economic fear that the president and his team are up against. They are up against a political party that is treating a public health crisis like a political opportunity.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's so hard to see daylight at the end of this thing. This isn't, you know, I go back to sort of the financial collapse. Like, we could see daylight at the end of that. You knew that Obama was going to come in, and there was a sense that he was going to sort of set the economy back on track, and it has. But this is very difficult because this, and the doctor could speak to this more so than I can, that we deal with this in waves. So the only way to actually fix, you know, sort of stop this tide is to enforce these measures at once in a very strong and consistent manner. We have not seen that. And it has, and it does have significant equity effects, not just in terms of who's getting tested and who's getting the vaccine, but if you think about it, there are a lot of teachers that aren't going to work because they're not vaccinated. There are police officers and firefighters that are not going to work because they're not being vaccinated. And if you have an entire party, political party nationally, doing everything in its power to essentially enable that, then you're going to have significant lapses in a lot of these in a lot of public policy areas. Just think about the fact that if you have a lot of teachers not going in to teach, how does that affect African American and Latino students in communities of color, or poor students across the country? What is the sort of disparate effect on them? And in so many other areas, whether it's crime, criminal justice, or even, you know, other forms of public safety. So mayors have their hands full trying to balance all of this in the middle of this sort of national fight that the Republicans are engaged with. And that's why that fatigue sets in, because it's so hard to see daylight when there's this constant bickering over something that for so many seems like such a simple idea and solution. Put your mask on, get vaccinated.
Simple solutions, Dr. Blackstock. Thank you, as always, my friend, for joining us. January 6th Select Committee treading cautiously today in announcing its deal with former chief of staff for Donald Trump, Mark Meadows. One of the committee members joins us on the other side of the break on what they're expecting from him. Stay with us. We are back with more on the breaking news. The Trump chief of staff, Mark Meadows, has reached a deal with the House Select Committee investigating January 6th to provide records and sit for an initial interview. The committee had been weighing a criminal contempt referral for Meadows due to his refusal to testify. Joining us now, a member of the House Select Committee on January 6th, Congressman Pete Aguilar of California. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us. You have said that Meadows could have a minor claim to executive privilege. What do you think he can bring you? What do you think he can reveal that is not privilege worthy?
Well, I think there's plenty of questions that we will have for Mr. Meadows, and I think that this is a good step. He has been engaged through his attorney and talking with the committee staff and the committee team. He's produced documents already, so these are all positive steps, and we would expect that out of someone who receives a lawful subpoena out of the work that the committee is doing.
Do you expect Meadows' cooperation to move Jeffrey Clark?
I don't know. I couldn't speak to Jeffrey Clark. What I can tell you is that, you know, we will take that up in the business committee tomorrow based on what Mr. Clark has done thus far. And so, you know, our suggestion is going to be that the House move forward with a contempt a referral to the Department of Justice. He has been so far unwilling to engage in any fruitful discussions and claimed both executive privilege and attorney-client privilege when he was in front of us. And so this is something that obviously we haven't seen, and we would expect a better level of engagement from someone who is a former Department of Justice official.
Congressman, when it comes to the D.C. Court of Appeals and arguments by the former president's lawyers to keep secret records that could provide insight into his actions on the day of the insurrection and the lead up to the insurrection, those arguments, I'm sure you heard today, met with skepticism by the three presiding judges, their comments. Who decides when it is in the best interest of the United States to disclose presidential records? Is it the current occupant of the White House or the former? We have a conflict of incumbent and former. Incumbent gets to decide. Another one, we have one president at a time under our Constitution. Congressman, do you expect, hearing all of that, the courts to rule in the committee's favor in this lawsuit?
We do. We think that it was a very thoughtful brief that the staff put together and argued incredibly well today. And so we expect a positive result. And, you know, ultimately, our goal here is to produce a document, to gather as much information as possible, both in witness interviews and in those documents from the National Archives that will help tell the story of January 5th and January 6th and the rallies and insurrection and the assault on democracy. That's our focus. That's our goal. And the more information, the better. And that's why these documents are so important.
I appreciate that the goal is to produce those documents. But if I'm understanding correctly, the goal is also to provide an accurate rendering of what happened so that there can be accountability both for what happened and also to set the stage so that this can never happen again. And I think the concern is that given the partisanship in Congress, do you expect your Republican colleagues to be able to take this document and read it as an accurate running, to take it as a collection of facts, and from there to actually engage in the conversation that is necessary to hold people accountable both retroactively and proactively?
If this is done right, then the American people will ultimately get to see that document and to get to make those decisions as well. Obviously, given some of the antics that we've seen from our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, you just never know what their behavior is going to be day to day. What I can tell you is that we're carrying forward in a very thoughtful way with this committee, not in a bipartisan way, but in a nonpartisan way. And Vice Chair Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, as well as Chairman Thompson, help guiding what we're doing here has been incredibly helpful and thoughtful to the end result, which is, as you highlighted, making sure that this never happens again and telling the full and complete story.
Congressman Pete Aguilar, thank you so much for your time. Angry and dangerous rhetoric being thrown around among colleagues on the Hill appears to be having an impact outside the halls of Congress as well. We're going to talk about that next.
Our work here matters. Our example matters. There is meaning in our service. And as leaders in this country, when we incite violence with depictions against our colleagues, that trickles down into violence in this country. And that is where we must draw the line, independent of party, identity, or belief.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez warning about the impact of violent rhetoric by Republican elected officials in Congress. That violent rhetoric appears to be having real-world consequences. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell reporting that her Michigan office was vandalized with windows broken and memorabilia smashed. Congresswoman tweeting about the incident, writing, quote, "The motive for today's incident is unclear, but what I can tell you is that the disrespect, violence, and division need to end in this country. My office has been receiving threats for months, and we take them very seriously." We're back with Basil Smichel and Yamiche Alcindor. Yamiche, you have leaders in the Republican Party that won't hold members of their party accountable for using this type of rhetoric. Where does that then leave us? Where does it leave the American people? What recourse do we have?
I mean, it's the key question of this generation, of this moment in politics and this moment in America. We have a political party that, despite sort of policy differences with Democrats, there's also this sort of underlying current of violence and of fear that lawmakers are sort of allowing to grow and grow and grow. And I don't know if that this is breaking into the mainstream just right now. Let's remember that former President Trump, that he encouraged people to punch people in the faces at his rallies, that people got so sort of excited at the idea of this sort of macho guy who was going to fight people physically in order to get into the White House. I remember interviewing people who were excited about the idea of his rhetoric of not treating people nicely, quote unquote, and banging their heads into police vehicles when they were getting arrested, if you can remember when the president was saying those things. So now, of course, you have, I think, this bubbling up into Congress where you have lawmakers tweeting animated videos of killing other lawmakers. I mean, I don't think I've ever thought I would be saying that sentence out loud and it not be sort of a hyperbolic sentence. That is exactly what's happening now. So I think we're in this sort of dystopia, frankly, where we are as Americans are trying to figure out sort of what is the next chapter of this. And it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better. It seems like it's going to get uglier and uglier. And I'm not quite sure, based on my reporting and based on talking to people, where it goes next.
Right. Basil, I think Yamiche gets it exactly right there, that there were a lot of people who thought, OK, this is Donald Trump. As soon as Donald Trump goes away, problem's going to be solved. It has not been that simple. I want to read you this from The New York Times. The headline, "Menace Enters the Republican Mainstream." Quote, "Even with the former president largely out of the public eye, the Republican acceptance of violence has only spread. Polling indicates that 30% of Republicans and 40% of people who most trust far-right news sources believe that true patriots may have to resort to violence to, quote, save the country. Such views, routinely expressed in warlike or revolutionary terms, are often intertwined with white racial resentments and evangelical Christian religious fervor, two potent sources of fuel for the GOP during the Trump era, as the most animated Republican voters increasingly see themselves as participants in a struggle, if not a kind of holy war, to preserve their idea of American culture and their place in society. Basil, if we are not honest about what is at the core of this, then we cannot get to the place where we can actually begin to fix it.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. White supremacy and white supremacist attitudes are at the heart of this, and we need to start really thinking and seriously and talking seriously as a country about domestic terrorism. We don't like to talk about that. We like to say it, sweep it under the rug, because that could, quote, never happen here, but it is happening here. I have to say, you know, as an African-American man, talking to many of my Black and Latino friends, when Donald Trump was running, we said he's going to light a match that will be very difficult to extinguish. And when, and I've been on this program talking about, while he was president, even during the campaign, the way his rhetoric, that toxic masculinity that he used as part of his rhetoric to sort of engage the crowd and fire up his crowd. And we did see, as Jimmy said, you know, moments where his supporters at these rallies were punching people who came through and or being taken out. That violence doesn't stop and start on a dime. It grows, it germinates, and then it metastasizes in ways that I don't know that our country, at least the institutions in our country, were not, they're not prepared to handle. And I don't, and to Demetrius' point as well, I don't see the way out. I don't know how we put a cap on this, except to say that, you know, we have to do our best to elect better people to office. And I'm mostly talking about folks on the Republican side. That said, the concern that I have is that this kind of terrorism keeps good people from going into public service. All of those folks that right. we say you'd be good to run for office will decide, I don't want this headache. And that is going to be the shame, that we just can't even recruit people to get into positions of power to make the kind of change that we're looking for.
Yeah, Yamiche, I always appreciate the honesty of an I don't know answer. And I think part of the theory of change is, you know, as Basil said there, that better people are elected. I also think there's always some hope that people who are inside the party are going to stand up. But that is why this new reporting from NBC News, you have Republican representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene, Nancy Mace throwing jabs at each other on Tuesday after Mace condemned Boebert's making anti-Muslim comments. Greene called Mace, quote, the trash of the GOP conference, and then May said, I have time after time condemned my colleagues on both sides of the aisle for racist tropes and remarks that I find disgusting, and this is no different than any other. Yamiche, I bring that up to ask, like, is there room in this Republican Party for someone like Representative Mace who's willing to do just the bare minimum of calling racism racism?
It's a great question, and I think, you know, as I was listening to sort of Representative Mace and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene go back and forth, I had to almost remind myself, we're talking about whether or not it's okay to insinuate, it seems, that your Muslim colleague could be a threat to you. That's the argument that they're having. Yep. I mean, that is obviously wrong, right? It's obviously stereotyping and criminalizing someone who does not deserve to do that. And I think that we have a real question about whether or not the GOP can have room for people who say that even goes a little too far when it comes to sort of discriminating against people. We're not sure. I don't think reporters and people who are looking at the GOP, we're not sure sort of where that party ends up.
Yes, it is the big open question. Basil, Yamiche, thank you both so much for spending some time with us. Up next, breaking news involving another school shooting. Sadly, three people believed to be students are dead. Much more after this.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
We are following the breaking news of a shooting at a high school in Oxford, Michigan, outside of Detroit. Three people have been killed and all are believed to be students. A 15-year-old suspect, a sophomore at the school, has been arrested. NBC News correspondent Maura Barrett is monitoring for us. Maura, what more do we know about what happened today?
Well, Alicia, this all unfolded incredibly quickly this afternoon. 911 calls, more than 100 of them coming into police dispatch around 1 p.m. this afternoon. And then police say they were able to arrest the shooter within 5 minutes of receiving those calls. Based on shell casings and the situation that they're currently investigating, they estimate that the shooter fired about 15 to 20 shots. Like you said, we now know three people have died, all of them believed to be students, and six people are injured. They were all transferred to local area hospitals for their injuries, but we don't know how severe the injuries are right now. One of those injured believed to be a teacher, the rest of them students. Police, as we know right now, are conducting secondary and tertiary searches of the high school to make sure that there aren't any more victims left behind. And we should be getting an update from the sheriff's office here probably within the next minute, a couple of minutes, we're expecting. And now we don't know a lot about the shooter himself. We know it's a 15-year-old sophomore student at the high school there in Oxford, but he invoked his right not to speak with police. He asked for a lawyer, and the police say that he has not made any statements indicating any sort of motive. So obviously a very troubling situation. These teenagers very much affected this afternoon. A local garden center has helped with evacuations after the high school pulled them out, and parents are now able to pick their students up this afternoon, Alicia.
Absolutely horrible. NBC's Maura Barrett, thank you. That does it for me. The next hour of Deadline White House with Jason Johnson starts right after this quick break.
I called around to a few abortion clinics to terminate the pregnancy, and the prices I was quoted felt, I mean, just, they were ridiculous. I could not save up enough money. If I tried, I was essentially, you know, forced to carry that pregnancy to term, even though I didn't want to. Being pushed further into poverty was definitely one of those fears, and it definitely happened. Our lights were off at some point, living on my own, because I needed to redistribute money within the household to make sure at least the rent is paid so we're not evicted.
Hi, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York, and I'm Jason Johnson in for Nicole Wallace. The less spoken about consequences of being denied an abortion, the physical, mental, and financial weight of it. Accounts like you just heard from Brittany Moss Tiller, a mother in Chicago who was essentially forced to carry her pregnancy to term and pushed into poverty, may sadly become a more common occurrence as a woman's right to choose in this country is under siege. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court begins to hear arguments in a case that takes direct aim at the nearly 50-year-old decision of Roe versus Wade, which said a woman's right to an abortion up until fetal viability is protected by the U.S. Constitution. The case the High Court will hear, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, essentially outlaws abortion after 15 weeks, much sooner than what is established in Roe. Noting this case's significance, the New York Times describes it as, quote, setting the stage for what could be the most consequential abortion rights ruling in decades. The Times adds, quote, if the justices were to approve the law, Roe's viability standard would no longer be the law of the land, unquote. The clinic at the center of this case is the only abortion clinic left in Mississippi. The only abortion clinic left in Mississippi. And another piece in the Times explores the challenges currently faced by the doctors and patients there. From that reporting, quote, although the Jackson Clinic's survival hangs in the balance, it has never been busier. In recent months, it has expanded its hours of operation from 3 days a week to five. The phone rings constantly with people trying to make appointments. Calling from across Mississippi and more from Texas, an influx attributed to the new law there that is the most restrictive in the country. The clinic now sees about 300 women a month. Quote, our patient load has almost doubled, said Shannon Brewer, the clinic's director. We are adjusting, she added. We just know it's got to be done. But the impact of the Supreme Court ruling will be felt way beyond that one clinic. A dozen states have trigger laws in place that would immediately ban abortions if Roe was overturned. Abortion rights in America hanging in the balance is where we start this hour. Joining us now is Cecile Richards, co-chair of the American Bridge and former president of Planned Parenthood. Also with us, MSNBC political analyst and former Congresswoman Donna Edwards and Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California, co-chair of the House Democrat Steering and Policy Committee. Congresswoman, I will begin with you. What's at stake here? Like, take us to the state by state story. What happens if the Supreme Court ends Roe versus Wade as we know it? How does that impact different kinds of states? And what would Congress be able to do, if anything, about it?
Thanks, Amanda and Jason, for having us this evening. First, it will really deny people's right to access an abortion. And it begins to actually erode take away and end Roe versus Wade. People have a right to make their own healthcare decisions. People have a right to make their decisions as it relates to having an abortion or not. And so what we're trying to do in Congress, and we passed in the House the Women's Health Protection Act, which would put into law, finally, abortion access and also the right to a safe and legal abortion. You know, this is an issue also about equity and barriers. Low-income women, primarily women of color, people of color, are denied access to the full range of reproductive health care, including abortions. And so what we're seeing now is in states where people can't afford to exercise their constitutional right, we see them not being able to travel because they don't have the money or for whatever reason. This is an issue around racism. It's an issue of equity. And we have to fight to make sure that we pass the Women's Health Protection Act. It's in the Senate now. And so I hope everyone will call their senators to make sure that they move forward and pass this bill, because this is a matter of life and death for so many people.
Cecile, I want to play you some sound from a virtual event in Congress yesterday where they were talking about what the potential impact of this new Supreme Court hearing and potential ruling could be. And I want to get your thoughts on the other side.
This infringement on women's rights, on our privacy, on the attempt to have state control of our personal health, really is what we would see in an authoritarian state. It's not what we would expect in New Hampshire. I think if you want to see a revolution, go ahead, outlaw Roe v. Wade, and see what the response is of the public, particularly young people.
Cecile, what are your thoughts about that? Do you think this revolution is possible, and how serious is this?
Well, I couldn't agree with Senator Shaheen more. This is anti-democratic. It's anti-American. And as Congresswoman Lee said, there is a way to address this, and that is through federal legislation. I would note that when this was passed in the House of Representatives, and I really thank her for her leadership, not a single Republican member of Congress voted to protect and support abortion access. And that's really what we're looking at here, is the Republican Party has been on an effort for the last several years to outlaw abortion. And what's happened now, after they put three members onto the Supreme Court in a highly partisan way under Donald Trump, we now have a Supreme Court that has refused to act on a Texas abortion ban that has now been in effect for nearly 3 months. And literally, this court has done nothing. This is the concern about this is widespread. It's far beyond Mississippi. It's far beyond Texas, because people around the country are realizing this could happen anywhere and it could happen everywhere. But make no mistake about it. This is a right that people everywhere have, regardless of political party. What I don't think the Republican Party understands is that more than 80% of Americans believe that the people who should make decisions about pregnancy are people who are pregnant, not the federal government, not politicians. And so the opportunity, in the voting booth and in the midterm elections to right these wrongs is going to be incredibly important. I'm so glad that this story is being covered, because literally the rights that we have had in this country for nearly 50 years are at stake before the Supreme Court.
Donna, now I have to be my usual somewhat cynical self. I hear that if the Supreme Court outlaws Roe versus Wade, or makes it essentially ineffective as law, that there will be a revolution at the polling place, that this will galvanize men and women, especially white women, to vote against the Republican Party. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. The Republicans have been singing this same song for in a very serious way, certainly the last 4 years, but the last 20, it doesn't seem to have had that much of an impact on voting. Looking at what this case could do, do you believe that if the Supreme Court ends Roe versus Wade, that we'll actually see an impact on that in a negative way for conservatives in the ballot box next year?
Well, Jason, here's what we do know is that an overwhelming majority of the American people believe that women should have a right to make a decision about an abortion because it's their body and their right. And we know that is true across demographic groups. We know that it is true no matter the age and income levels. And so I do think that over generations, there has never been a greater threat to abortion rights and access to abortion than there is right now. So does it have the potential to galvanize generations, legions of younger people for whom abortion rights and the access to abortion has been part of their lives for their entire reproductive lives? And so I think that there is a potential, but I think it requires leadership and it requires us to galvanize the American public and make sure that they understand what's been placed at stake. And I thank the leadership of Congresswoman Lee and Democrats in the House for standing up for women's access to abortion. And the Senate needs to act as well. I think that we are at a stage right now where there is such a threat to democratic governance, and that includes the right, the constitutionally protected right to make decisions about whether or not to have an abortion. And that is under threat, and laws across the country in states will fall as a result of overturning Roe versus Wade.
Congresswoman Lee, I want to play some audio from you talking about the importance and significance of being able to get access to free and affordable abortions, and get your thoughts on the other side.
I was one of the lucky ones, Madam Chair. A lot of girls and women in my generation didn't make it. They died from unsafe abortions. In the 1960s, unsafe septic abortions were the primary killer of African-American women.
Congresswoman, you had to leave the country to get an abortion. So you have lived what it was like in this country when abortion it was not a part of women's health care they could get access to. Do you think things could get that dire that quickly in this country again if the Supreme Court does what we all expect them to try to do with the current 6-3 rulings in favor of conservatives?
Jason, you know, people make these grueling decisions. This was a terrible, heart-wrenching decision that I had to make at age 16. And let me tell you, this was way before Roe versus Wade. And what I worry about and what I think everyone is concerned about is a return to unsafe abortions. And so what we're fighting for is to make abortions safe, to make them legal, to make them accessible, and to make sure that everyone, regardless of their income, regardless of their background, have access to safe and legal abortions. And that's why we're working, and I'm really proud to say that we have the most pro-choice caucus, Democratic caucus ever. I co-chair the pro-choice caucus. Congresswoman Judy Chu led with her bill, the Women's Health Protection Act. And so we are clear that, and what Donna said about young people, I think we're going to see a turnout at the polls because young people, this is all young people know. They don't know what it was like when I was growing up and before Roe versus Wade, Wade, excuse me, and people were dying, women were dying behind unsafe abortions. And we can't go back there because, as I said earlier, this is a matter of life and death. And this is a personal decision. It's a decision that whether you agree or disagree with abortions, this is a person's right to make their own decisions about their own health care and their own lives.
Cecile, one of the things that concerns me and concerns a lot of people out there is that these restrictive abortion laws and what the Supreme Court might do has a disproportionate impact on poor women and women of color. I'm looking at these stats now. Non-Hispanic Black women receive 38.4% of abortions, far higher than the 13.4% share of the U.S. population that Black people actually make up. Non-Hispanic whites receive 33%. Hispanic women receive 21%. White women have the lowest rate of abortions. When we see these kinds of numbers, is it also fair to say that the Supreme Court is attacking, again, shockingly, or potentially attacking women of color and poor women because this seems to be a resource that Black and Latina women use a lot more than white women?
Well, I think we have to go back to the point, I think, that and Barbara's Congresswoman Lee's story is so important. You know, abortion is always going to exist. It's the question is simply whether it's going to be safe and legal and whether it's going to be available to everyone. Believe me, when abortion is outlawed, if it is by this Supreme Court, wealthy women in this country will still be able to get an abortion because they'll be able to get on a plane, go somewhere, take care of just as they did before Roe. This is going to disproportionately fall on women with low incomes. Young people, we're already hearing stories of young people in Texas having literally nowhere to turn. Women of color, women who work in minimum wage jobs where they can't take off 5 days and drive to another state and receive access to safe and legal abortion. So, of course, it is going to have a detrimental effect on people who already have the least access to health care. But that's really the irony, Jason, about all of this. And my colleagues on this panel know this very well. This my home state of Texas, where now essentially abortion access to safe and legal abortion right. practically does not exist. It is a state with some of the worst access to health care in the country, the worst rates of maternal mortality for Black women in the country, continually refusing to expand Medicaid access for people. So I think what this case is about, it's not simply about access to safe and legal abortion. It's about the ability to make your decision about your pregnancy and whether to have to continue a pregnancy or not. The cruelty of all of these kinds of bills, they do nothing to help people make a free decision about what to do about their pregnancy. And that includes bringing a child into this world who can have clean drinking water, good public schools, a safe neighborhood, and the rest. And it's part of a much bigger tapestry. I'm grateful to Congresswoman Lee for all of her fights for reproductive justice. But this Supreme Court and these kinds of laws, they penalize the people who have the least access to options already in this country, and they are cruel. And I hope to goodness that this Supreme Court is listening to women.
Don, I want to close with this because I think this is really important. It's been so interesting for me, and I'm sure everybody on this panel, to observe that conservatives over the last year and a half of this global pandemic have suddenly tried to co-opt this language of my body, my choice. I don't have to wear a mask when I go into Whole Foods. And yet they seem to not care about that when people were saying that for the previous 30 years when it comes to my body, my choice and people having access to abortion. Donna, do you think, again, rhetorically, that hypocrisy is going to blow up in any Republican's face? Will it blow up in the integrity or the reputation of the Supreme Court? Or is this such a power grab at this point that it won't matter?
I don't know. I mean, I think none of us is surprised by the hypocrisy anymore. But what really is clear is that we know that abortion rights and access to abortion is supported by an overwhelming majority of American people, and that they are going to care about that when they show up in November for elections, because it might be the first time that we've had in nearly 50 years where women will not have access to the kind of reproductive health care that they need and access to abortion. And so I don't want to worry about the hypocrisy. I want to worry about making sure that we educate the American people about what's at stake and that they respond accordingly.
Cecile Richards, Donna Edwards, and Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you. This is a powerhouse panel. Thank you for starting us off for this hour.
Thank you.
When we return, why the far right is making noise about Trump's other big lie that the Russian investigation was a hoax. That story's next. Plus, speaking of Russia, guess who's behind the Texas secession movement, which Ted Cruz is warming up to? Turns out it's part of the Kremlin's ongoing active measures campaigns. And later, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter behind a brand new book on Trump's fleecing of America. Deadline White House continues after a quick break, so don't go anywhere.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
We'll call them Donald Trump's Shoot Somebody on Fifth Avenue crowd. That segment of the American public predisposed to support him no matter what, to believe his lies no matter what. They've got a favorite word for the unknown surrounding Trump's relationship with Russia, and you know it. They call it a hoax. It's been like that ever since the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee published factual, certifiable evidence of business dealings and suggestions of political cooperation in the lead up to the 2016 election. Again, to them, it was always a hoax. But recently, after further scrutiny of the Steele dossier, that wholesale dismissal of everything we know about Trump and Russia has caught on with the anti-Trump crowd, those outside that Trump bubble who sometimes see common cause. The result, what David Frum today called a project of retrospective denial from his piece in The Atlantic. Quote, the Steele dossier undertook to answer the question, what the hell is going on with Trump and Russia? It was to silence that question that the outgoing Trump administration appointed a special counsel of its own to investigate its investigators. John Durham has now issued three indictments, all for lying to the FBI about various aspects of the Steele dossier. None of these indictments vindicates Trump's claims in any way. It remains fact that Russian hackers and spies helped his campaign. It remains fact that the Trump campaign welcomed the help. It remains fact that Trump's campaign chairman sought to share proprietary campaign information with a person whom the Senate report identified as a Russian intelligence officer. It remains fact that Trump hoped to score a huge payday in Russia even as he ran for president. It remains fact that Trump and those around him lied and lied and lied and lied again about their connections to Russia. Joining us now is former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul and Rick Stengel, a former top State Department official and member of the Biden transition team. Lucky for us, both are MSNBC contributors. So, Rick, I want to start with you, and I want to tread lightly on this, but I think this is important. This group of anti-Trump supporters, the way I define them, a lot of them I saw as part of the sort of former online left, right? The people who, they may have not liked Trump, but they dislike the Democratic Party, and they dislike the media so much that even with their own failings, the sort of Glenn Greenwalds, Crystal Balls, those sorts of people, they wanted to justify anything to attack the mainstream press or attack the Democratic Party as a whole. And they are part of these attacks on what are the real facts of the Steele dossier and what happened in the Russian investigation. My question for you, Rick, is how do we combat the sort of disinformation, not just from your far right people like, you know, anybody on Fox, but also from the former fake lefties who have now decided that attacking anything that has to do with Trump and Russia is another part for them to achieve the grand revolution that we knew they were never going to get?
That's complicated, Jason. Here's what I would say, though. I mean, because I think that what this comes down to at the moment is the fact that people are questioning the Steele dossier. And they have every right to question the Steele dossier. But the Steele dossier had nothing to do with Russia interfering in our election and Trump cooperating with Russia. In fact, I think it makes sense to divide it into those two categories. The first one is absolutely indisputable. Russia interfered in our election. They didn't meddle in our election. That's what your grandmother does in the kitchen. They interfered, they poisoned, they tried to disrupt our election, and they are continuing to try to make people not trust American election. The question that Mueller looked at and the Senate Intelligence Report less so is, was Trump cooperating in a kind of conspiratorial way with Russia's efforts? And that is still not completely clear. And Mueller said that Trump, cooperated, but whether it was witting or unwitting, I don't know. But a lot of this comes down to the fact that people are using the Steele dossier as a kind of stalking horse to try to question everything else, which is, by the way, exactly what Putin does. He takes a small lie and then he tries to blow up the larger truth. And that's what Trump is trying to do.
So, Rick, I want to follow up on this because I think this is key. We're not just seeing that with the Steele dossier and the Trump investigation, because, again, as we said at the beginning of this show, what Trump was doing and the relationships that his campaign had with Russia would have made it impossible for anybody in the lower levels of government to get a security clearance. Like, let's be clear. What he was doing was unethical. You usually can't get away with it. He only managed to get away with it because he managed to get himself elected president of the United States. But we're seeing this same sort of attitude from these former fake lefties and the far right when now it comes to January 6th, where they find one thing about January 6th that they say is incorrect or misreported, and now suddenly all of January 6th was just a whole bunch of people being upset as opposed to a white nationalist attempt to overthrow the government. Is this all sort of part of the same disinformation campaign, or are these simply people who are incapable of understanding basic facts because they desperately want a new reality that serves their purposes?
Yeah, Jason, I don't know the answer to that either, and I find it so dispiriting that people are questioning the fact that there was an attempted insurrection of the United States on January 6th. That's just apparent. I mean, some of this just goes back to human nature, something we've been dealing with for a long time, which is that people don't really pay attention to politics, not quite the way that we do. And then someone can find one tiny little bit of exonerating evidence about January 6th, and people who haven't read all the interviews, haven't read all the stories, who haven't watched all the video, they go, well, maybe that's plausible. And that's what the disinformationists count on. That's what the Trumpist, useful idiots count on, which is the fact that people are not paying attention and that you can call out one particular thing, one small detail, and it makes them question the larger truth. That's what we're looking at all the time.
Michael, I want to continue with this. I want to play you some audio from Morning Joe earlier today about the proper perspective with which to have on things like January 6th and Russia and understand how we should really be discussing in America. Get your thoughts on the other side.
What we needed all along to be looking for was the question, why did Russia do this extraordinary thing in 2016? Russia has an economy the size of Italy. Everybody assumed that Hillary Clinton would probably win. What a terrible risk they ran in 2016 to help someone who was probably going to lose. Why would they do that? Why did they care so much? That was the mystery. And the answer was not going to be found by prosecuting crimes. The answer is going to be found through counterintelligence.
Now, Michael, I will say up front, I don't know that I believe that Russia had a material impact on the end result of the election. There were some polling numbers that I saw. Things might have been moving in Trump's way to win the Electoral College. But to deny that they were trying to do something to America that, quite frankly, America has done around the world for a century seems incredibly naive to me. So my question is, do you agree with sort of David Frum where it's like, why would they take this risk? And then also, do you think that what the Russians attempted to do in 2016, do you think it actually had a material impact on how the election played out?
Well, I'm glad you're disaggregating those two thoughts, right? To emphasize what Rick just said, there is overwhelming evidence that Russia intervened in our election in 2016. By the way, in 2020 as well. We'll come back to that maybe later. But in 2016, in a major way, they violated our sovereignty. Let's use a little stronger language, right? What is the most sovereign thing we do as Americans? One of them is we choose our leaders independent of outside actors. And in this case, Vladimir Putin invested big resources to try to undermine the free and fairness of our election. He stole data from one of the campaigns. Let's use that verb. He stole data, intellectual property, from the Clinton campaign and then leaked it to WikiLeaks as a way to undermine one of the candidates. He used his media efforts, RT, Sputnik. When you tweet out hashtag crooked Hillary, you don't need to have a PhD in political science or Russian studies to understand what they're trying to do. So that part is that's overwhelming. We have the Mueller report. We have the Senate investigations. By the way, we academics have also written hundreds of pages on that fact. The second piece is harder, and you're right to disaggregate that. So that's the cause was that the Russians were trying to influence the election. I do not think we have the scientific data to say that that independent factor of the Russian intervention caused Trump to win. But the fact that they were trying, I think, is overwhelming.
Right. It's like if I'm trying to break into your car, it's still a problem, even if I don't manage to get the ignition started. I want to follow up with this very quickly. What do you think the motivation? Because, again, we understand the motivation of Republicans and Trump supporters. Where do you think the anti-Trump people's motivations come from? Some of them might be independent. Some of them might be former. Some of them, again, cosplay as liberals online. What do you think their motivation is in trying to debunk the impact of these investigations?
That's a big, hard question. You keep asking it. You didn't get an answer from Rick, so you asked me, right?
Yeah.
You know, I can explain Putin. I mean, Putin wanted to undermine our democracy. He didn't like Secretary Clinton. Trump was going to do good things for him. It was very rational for Putin to support President Trump. With respect to that category of people, you know, I think they just don't trust the American liberal establishment, and I've been attacked by these people frequently, and so the enemy is my friend. And I think tragically they've put themselves in a place where they're aligning, in my view, with things that are not ethical. They're most certainly not democratic, and in some cases, you know, they are supporting things that I think are illegal and should not happen in the United States of America.
Most definitely. Ambassador McFaul and Rick Stengel, they're staying with us. And when we return, as Ted Cruz cozies up to the Texas secessionist crowd, there's new reporting into the Russian roots of the Lone Star State's growing secession movement. That's next. Stay with us. A new analysis reveals the roots and immediate dangers of this suggestion made by Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz a few weeks ago, that Texas could secede from the U.S. if Republicans don't get their way.
Texas is right now an amazing force keeping America from going off the cliff. I think we have a responsibility. Now, listen, if the Democrats end the filibuster, if they fundamentally destroy the country, if they pack the Supreme Court, if they make D.C. a state, if they federalize elections and massively expand voter fraud, there may come a point where it's hopeless. We're not there yet. And if there comes a point where it's hopeless, then I think we take NASA, we take the military, we take the oil.
Good gracious. This week, the Bulwark highlights the deep Russian origins of today's Texas secession movement and the seriousness of an all-too-comfortable sitting U.S. senator giving oxygen to Putin's investment in American extremism that can be convincing and deadly. Christopher Harrison writes, it is important to understand that the modern secession movement is not a product of Lone Star pride. It's an idea that has been force-fed into the American conservative movement by Russia. Secession is one of the Kremlin's active measures campaigns. Promote fringe wackos abroad and hope that eventually they break something. This may not sound like much of a plan, but sometimes it works. We're back with Ambassador Michael McFaul and Rick Stengel. Ambassador McFaul, I got to start with you on this, because from an international perspective, I can understand somebody saying, aha, we'll get Texas to succeed and then nobody will have to watch Texans games and we'll be done with Dallas. I get that part. Those things are good. But at a practical level, it actually would hurt the Republican Party, because if Texas somehow left the U.S. Union, it's sort of like what you have in England right now. Once Ireland sort of left, now Labor can't really win any national elections. What is the value of promoting something as ridiculous as Texas secessionism? I understand that Ted Cruz is a kiss-up, but why would Russia care?
Well, Well, first of all, the idea that anybody would support secessionist movement in the United States, that weakens the United States of America. Let's be clear about that at the get-go. Maybe he was making a joke. I don't know. But that is not an American who wants America to be strong in the world. That weakens the United States of America. And that's exactly what Vladimir Putin wants. America is not the only country that he supported secessionist movements. He supported them in Spain. He supported it in Scotland. He supported the Brexit movement in the UK, all designed to weaken countries and the European Union that he considers his enemy. And in the United States, he foments these ideas. He creates alliances with American organizations, extremist nationalist organizations, which he believes if they become stronger, the United States of America as a country in the international system becomes weaker. Now, whether people are joking about it or understand that, I don't know that. I'm not an expert on that. But there's no doubt in my mind that that is what Vladimir Putin is seeking to do. He wants to weaken America, supporting a secessionist movement in Texas or Northern California. They do another one here. That weakens the United States of America.
Rick, I want to put up this map on the screen. Every other year or so, some political scientist, some sociologist is like, oh, yes, the United States could easily break into multiple countries. There'd be a Southern and a Midwestern and a Heartland and everything else like that. Most of this I find to be a ridiculous turtle dove fan fiction. But what it speaks to is that America is a unique place. There aren't that many countries, Nigeria, some places in India, there aren't that many countries that have this much diversity that have managed to stay a coherent nation for 200 plus years. And for the rest of the world, the idea that these internal conflicts we have could lead to this country breaking up isn't so crazy. What do we have to do as a nation to sort of project to the rest of the world, hey, look, this is an internal family squabble, and we're not about to break into 100 different pieces?
Well, we have to tell our story, Jason. I mean, our story, I mean, it's not very popular to use the term American exceptionalism now, but I would use it in the sense of we are the only diverse democratic country of our size in history. I mean, you know, going back to the Greeks, you know, Plato didn't think you could have a democracy this big. Even the founders didn't think you could have a democracy this big. And I would go back to Mike's point. You know, we always think that the Russians have a specific purpose in supporting Donald Trump. What they support is chaos. What they support is undermining democracy. They've been supporting secessionist movements around the world since the Cold War. They don't even know what the outcome is going to be. They want to disrupt the order of America. And so they tap into things that are already there. The Russians don't create discord. They amplify it through disinformation. And some of these things are part of our genetic makeup as Americans. You know, the Texans are proud of their own state. Lots of regions of the country are proud of their own state. But what the Russians try to do is to take that as a kind of germ and use it to sow discord, disharmony in the United States of America.
Ambassador Michael McFaul and Rick Stengel, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We have breaking news regarding the investigation by the January 6th Select Committee. NBC News confirming what the Atlanta Journal-Constitution first reported, that Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger was interviewed by the committee for several hours today. Raffensperger said he spoke at length about that infamous phone call from President Trump asking him to, quote, find the votes that would overturn Joe Biden's victory in Georgia. Raffensperger telling the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, we talked about that and everything else leading into the election. That was their focus because that was where the greatest disinformation was foisted upon our nation. He added that the committee had copies of his recently published book on hand to reference. When we return, investigative reporter David K. Johnston will join us with his new book about how the disgraced ex-president fleeced the nation. Alderman Rich himself and his family. Deadline White House continues after a quick break.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, He created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Look, Donald Trump has made it very clear, right, that he is grifting off of the American people, these supporters, these individuals that are just sending money to him at record levels. It's really amazing that people don't see exactly what the guy is doing. And this is really important for all of the viewers as well. One of the things Donald Trump has done is grift off of the big lie that the election was stolen from him in 2020. It was not stolen from him.
That was Michael Cohen on Meet the Press this past Sunday, talking about how the twice impeached, disgraced former blogger president in Florida is grifting off the American people, all to raise money and fight against the big lie that the election was stolen from him. You know, that grift. It's the subject of the latest book from journalist and author David K. Johnston, who has profiled Trump over the last 10 years and reveals the financial misdeeds of the Trump family. The book is entitled The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. David K. Johnston joins us now. David, great to speak to you again. This is the thing that gets me. Right off the bat, I figure at this point, if you're getting fleeced by Donald Trump, right? There's but so many times that somebody can send you an email that says, I'm a prince in a foreign country. Please send me $20,000. If you fall for it three times, don't you almost deserve it? So the people who are still being fleeced by Donald Trump, are they victims or volunteers at this point?
Well, there certainly are people I describe in the book who were victims, like a dying man who sent $500, half of his income for the month. And then the Trump campaign tapped his bank account until they drained it. And they did this to many, many, many people. The people who are donating today, I think many of them simply have come to hate America. They're very unhappy for reasons I've described in the 33 years I've been covering Donald. The bottom 90% of Americans had a smaller income in 2019 than they did in 1973, for example. Last year, I just reported that of all the pay raises in America in 2020, 82% of the money went to people who already make over $1 million a year. And the median pay raise was only $26. So a lot of people are really unhappy about conditions in America. And they see Donald as their savior. Even though he has no capacity to do that, he's really out just to line his pockets, his family's pockets, and in his administration, encourage others, including two cabinet secretaries I read about, to use the government to enrich themselves and their families rather than serving the public in a position of trust.
So, David, this is something else. You're on your third book now, and I have enjoyed your previous two books. Usually the trilogies, the third one isn't great, like The Matrix or Star Wars. Yours are great. I am assuming this third one is going to be fantastic. And it's not the conclusion of the Trump saga, because he's still trying to enrich himself and his family. So my question now is, what motivated you to write this book? Is it as a warning for what America needs to take into consideration in 2022 and 2024? Or is it sort of a reminder, hey, if you guys weren't listening, this guy is not taking the defeat in 2020 as a stopgap. It's an opportunity to steal more money. What was sort of the motivation here?
Well, Jason, you had a great discussion earlier in this hour about how a couple of facts are being abused to get people to not understand the relationship that Trump has had with the Russians since the early 80s and how the Kremlin has been courting him since 1987 and how he has been used through brilliant spycraft. Well, similarly, when it comes to finances and ripping off the public and taxpayers, what I realized was throughout the Trump administration, there were these loose threads. There'd be something here would be in the news for a day and something else here. And what I did was say, trying to tell people that all of that isn't going to work. Instead, pull together the enough loose threads and create a tapestry so people can see how they were doing this, what they were doing, why it's inimical to your interests. And most importantly, at the end, there actually are solutions to this that I lay out. Now, since Donald Trump left office, it's very clear that what he's doing is he's become America's beggar in chief. That's how he makes his living. He begs for money. And he's going to need a lot of it once he's indicted to pay criminal defense lawyers, just in the case in Manhattan, never mind if he's indicted in the other locations.
The new book is The Big Cheat by David K. Johnston. You've got to get this book. He's probably the best analyst on Trump that we have. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Jason.
We'll be right back after a quick break. There's an important runoff election happening today, right now, in fact, perhaps worth more national attention. Voters in Atlanta are electing their 61st mayor, among some other positions. There are two names appearing on the ballot for Atlanta mayor today. The candidates, Felicia Moore, former city council president, and two-term council member Andre Dickens, are both Democrats, both running on fixing Atlanta's issues with traffic, crime, and affordable housing. But symbolically, Atlanta is about more than roads and taxes. It's one of the last chocolate cities in America. It's a hub for black culture. It's become the Hollywood of the South. However, this race is about more than the Coca-Cola Museum, the championship Braves, and unfounded threats to close Magic City. Atlanta is ground zero in the fight against Republican voter suppression efforts. Whoever wins the election will be in the vanguard against attempts to suppress the Metro Atlanta vote in next year's midterm elections. Polls close at 8 p.m. Eastern. Something to keep track of. We'll be right back after this break. Thank you for being with us this hour. Nicole will be back tomorrow.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.